Emma Talk, ripple testing. This is 2 Emma Talk, ripple testing. Hello, CQ. Hello.
Right. I'm joined today by former Marconi man, historian and author, lecturer and curator of science and industry at Chelmsford City Museum, Tim Wander. And Tim has written a number of books about the birth of radio, and we've managed to persuade him to come in and talk to us today because on St. Valentine's Day, 14th of February, back in 1922, what we might call the first radio station in the UK to present regular programmes was born in a former army hut, then owned by the Marconi Company in Rittle, just outside Chelmsford. So this year marks the centenary of that event. So welcome to Phoenix FM, Tim.
Scott, it's really nice to be here, and good to also see you in person by the wonders of this thing we call radio.
I'm blown away by it all, I have to tell you. Now, look, like for so many firsts, this was not actually the first station to launch, was it?
No, I mean, the history of radio has always been, I guess, specified by dead ends and good ideas and experiments. So if you look at the history of broadcasting, it's very different to the history of radio. So the young Guglielmo Marconi came here in 1897, came to Chelmsford in 1898, and as the pioneer and the inventor of radio, which was then known as wireless, he would drive forward his company and develop the technology and the system of wireless telegraphy. That's Morse code for the military, for the marine industry, and that becomes a worldwide enterprise that will challenge the undersea cables. But what we're looking at is something very different. Marconi's model for radio was Morse code messages from one person to another, from point to point. And he built his business on that that would last for 100 years. But the ability to broadcast, to send messages from one place to many people, was actually experimented with as early as 1912, when a lovely guy called Grindel Matthews became, I guess, one of the very early pioneers to try and send broadcasting messages out. But he got caught up in the First World War. Interesting enough, his assistant was a guy called W.T. Ditcham, who would, after war service, join the Marconi Company. But during the First World War, Scott, it's where the world is going to change, because sadly, during wartime, technology is always driven, the pace of development is driven so hard, I guess, by our requirement to wage warfare harder and stronger, and I'm sadly to kill more people. But it is in the 1914-1918 Great War that broadcasting is going to find its roots.
So how did 2MT come to be born?
Well, again, it is born out of the seeds of war, because during the First World War, the problem was the Royal Navy had adopted Marconi's wireless system very early using Morse code. The Army was a slow adopter, but gradually moved into it. But the Royal Flying Corps, which on 1st of April 1918 will become the RAF, they suddenly realized that they really needed radio, but in a open cockpit fighter, using Morse code and a spark transmitter doesn't work. You just cannot hear it over gunfire and the engine noise and the interference. So very early on in 1915, a massive call went out to develop a new wireless telephony speech transmission system. And a group of brilliant men were assembled at Brooklands at the old motor racing track to develop this system. Among them was a young engineer called Peter Pendleton Eckersley. And what they did over those 2-3 years, using this new amazing device called the thermionic valve, which is going to move technology in terms of amplification and sensitivity and be able to detect radio, such that by 1918, the Royal Air Force had over 3,000 aircraft equipped with radio, as we would know it, talking from plane to plane and from ground to plane. It was used for artillery spotting. And although it didn't make a huge contribution, it certainly changed the face of warfare. But our story starts in 1919, because all these soldiers and sailors and airmen come home those who had survived, of course. And they had been trained in the use of radio. They'd seen it operate. This is millions of men. And of course, bless them, the military decide to drop huge amounts of ex-army surplus equipment and the wondrous new glass glowing valves onto the marketplace. And you suddenly get this huge group of wireless pioneers, radio amateurs, we used to know them as hams, radio hams. So the world is ready for something to happen. How do we get to Rittle? Well, it starts because the Marconi Company, based in Chelmsford, at the Marconi New Street Works, have a really interesting philosophy in blue sky research. The Marconi Company has been very successful. It's had a very successful war years developing radio and equipment. And two engineers, Bill Ditcham from the very early trials, and a hugely important character called Henry Joseph Round, who will win the Military Cross for his work in radio direction finding during World War I. They came together to do a series of experiments in 1919 with high power speech. There was no idea of a broadcasting system or radio stations or music. It was purely experimental. Now, interestingly, they couldn't start their trials in 1919 from Chelmsford because the Chelmsford New Street Works was shut down. The whole country was in lockdown. Sounds very familiar today. The world was being racked by a huge pandemic of the Spanish flu. Now, we're still living through our pandemic 100 years later, but the Spanish flu was catastrophic. I mean, it's estimated that between 70 and even 100 million people died in 3 years. That is five times more than the entire casualties in the tragic First World War. It was a virulent disease. But we have to remember, Scott, is that really all the people who were in lockdown, who were sitting at home wearing face masks, they did not know what was happening. It is 100 years ago. There is no internet. There's no television. There's no radio. Even the newspapers stop. You are sat in isolation, hoping that someone might put the town crier might shout from the end of the street. So if you put all these pieces together, so suddenly down Round and Ditcham head over to Ballybunion on the west coast of Ireland, about as far from the pandemic as you get, and they start transmitting using 6,000 watts, just basically playing with this new technology of high-power valves. And by accident, in March 1919, Ditcham's voice becomes the first ever to cross the Atlantic from east to west, interfering with the harbour ports in the marine traffic in America. It proved successful, but Round and Ditcham hate the wet and rainy bogs of Ireland. By December 1919, they come back to Chelmsford. We're just coming out of one of the waves of Spanish flu. So in January 1920, they had decided that they would start a second round of tests. They send a message out to all the Marconi stations and marine operators around the world saying that from 7 to 7.30 in the morning and from 7 to 7.30 in the evening, before work had started and after it finished, they're going to just transmit for half an hour, and those stations should telegram in and see if they heard them and how good the signal was and what they heard. So Round and Ditcham start this program of transmissions, and initially they just start reading Bradshaw's train timetable from cover to cover, literally stopping mid-word at the 8:32. We'll stop at Chelmsford, and they would pick up exactly a day later that evening. By the Friday of the first week, they'd had enough. And
riveting program.
It is. It's probably the first work of fiction ever transmitted on radio. I think because the trains didn't work very well, and that will be a story for later. But on the Friday, Ditcham picks up a newspaper from New Street, the New Street station in Chelmsford. He sits down, opens the paper, and starts to read it from left to right. He doesn't think anything about it. That evening, he does the same thing. The next morning, Arthur Burrows, the director of publicity for Marconi, storms into the studio, into the workshops, and go, "Gentlemen, what did you do yesterday? because there's 30 people outside the door banging on the door saying, they loved your news broadcast, do it again. And suddenly you see it's gone full circle. The military surplus equipment, the desire for news, the radio amateurs, and by pure coincidence, these tests have started something that will start snowball. So through the next week, Down and Ditcham decide it's just an experiment. They'll maybe try and get a singer. And a lady called Winifred Sayer, a young Chelmsford lass from Hoffman's ball bearing work. She was a ball bearing finisher. She came along, she was a part-time singer. She becomes the first lady to sing on British radio. They try transmitting oboes and clarinets and pianos, and they don't work very well. So Winifred has to sing by just a tuning fork. They learn a huge amount, but at the end of March, the experiment finishes. It's just a private experiment under an experimental call sign. So it was Mike Zulu X-ray was the call sign back there. However, a gentleman called Lord Northcliffe, then the proprietor, director general of the Daily Mail, they also own the Times. He picked it all up and said, that's really fascinating. He had a love of new technologies. He'd been part of the Snyder race, which will lead to the Spitfire. He loved aircraft. But in 1920, he basically says, what I need to do is a big concert, something that will show what this technology can do. Now, a lady called Dame Nellie Melba had just started a series of concerts at the Royal Albert Hall. He basically rang her agent and said, we'd like you to sing for the wireless. A reply, sir, my voice is not a subject for experimentation by young wireless wizards and their magic play boxes, which looking at your studio is probably about right. and they offered her £1,000, which is probably about £100,000 a day. She went, yep, I'll be there. So Dame Nellie Melba came along to the studio in June 1920, put a half-hour concert out, which we celebrated just 2 years ago, sadly in the middle of the pandemic, so all the events were lost. And there are moments in time when the world changes, and that was a moment. That was an amazing moment. Her concert, followed a week later by a concert by Dame Clara Butt, which we forget, a week later by Lawrence Melchior. These are huge stars.
Yeah.
These concerts go around the globe. They even hear bits in Australia. They hear in America. Tens of thousands of people listen in. Harrods and all the shops in London. There are wireless societies now being formed. It is a major event. You would think this is the birth of British broadcasting. It's not. In November 1920, there was a big problem. When Chelmsford was on air, 15,000 watts by now, you're probably running less than 100 in the studio. And the masts, 450 feet high, huge aerials, their signal was smashing across Europe, across the world.
Yeah.
And when Chelmsford was on air, nothing else could transmit or receive.
Yeah.
There was a problem with that because the military were using radio. The new airlines from Croydon were using the radio. So there's a famous instance of a de Havilland DH9 on a route back from Paris with 30 passengers all enjoying luxury, sitting in wicker chairs, being served four-course meals with champagne, much as they do today. And they were desperately looking for direction, information, and weather reports, and all they could hear was a pleasant musical soiree from Chelmsford. Mm-hmm. The Royal Navy weren't overly impressed either. And in November 1920, the Postmaster General, the Right Honourable F.G. Kellaway MP, shut Chelmsford down. Now, between you and I, it was an issue. Marconi had spent a huge amount of time and energy and resources, because they're not getting paid for this.
Sure.
Melba was paid, but also Marconi, the man himself, who is a massive figure in the history of radio, he'd taken a long, hard look at the business and went, how do we make money? Because in his world, you send a message from one station to another, you've provided the equipment and the maintenance, you've provided the operators, and a lot of cases you get paid per word on the message. Now you build one radio station, which will last for 25 years, and it broadcasts and potentially millions can listen. How do you pay for it? How do I get paid? And that's a problem that has echoed down through the past 100 years and is still in the history of radio, something we have to solve, as you'll appreciate from what the BBC is going through now.
Indeed.
Indeed. So what we are now is that by the end of 1920, the whole of the airwaves lapsed into silence. America takes on broadcasting and it goes mad.
Yeah.
Thousands of stations start in every small town. Commercial, everybody who's selling tires or cakes or bread were two popular ones. And also a lot of religious organizations and a lot of unsavory organizations, including the rise of the right wing, all get radio stations, all interfering with each other. So they start to just increase the power, which is why you now get radio stations in America which still have 50,000 watts. And Britain was determined that this was not going to happen here. But of course, what you've done now is you've let the genie out of the bottle.
Yep.
So in 1921, the Wireless Society, 63 wireless societies have formed. There are thousands, tens of thousands of radio amateurs and listeners. And many members of the general public have been able to go along to special evenings and listen in. They really want radio. The Spanish flu is still with us. They want news. They want updates. By the end of 1921, the huge petition that was put in to the government gained some traction. And so on the 25th of January, 1922, Kellaway announces that, yes, radio broadcasting can come back to Britain. They have a look around. They go and visit the Marconi Company, and the Marconi Company goes, well, you know, we're not overly interested. and also there's a problem. All the big equipment that you don't want us to use has been moved onto other things. Round and Ditcham have got other big projects on that are important. However, over in the small village of Rittle, just about 2.5-3 miles outside Chelmsford, we have a team of engineers who were Royal Flying Corps, later RAF engineers. Remember back at Brooklands, these were the men who had developed radio for the aircraft. Yeah. Well, they are all hired by Marconi's after the war, and they then go on to build what we now know as civil aviation, making amazing sets, all called AD, AD1 to AD, I think 400 by the time they finished 30 years later.
Mm.
So they are the birthplace of civilian aviation, ground control, air traffic control, direction finding, and it all mashes together for what came out of the war. And of course, these young engineers have survived the war. They're young men. They're enjoying themselves. They're isolated from the formality of head office, and they are very successful. They're flat out. So Arthur Burroughs, who'd hosted Dame Nellie Melba, goes over to see Peter Eckersley in January 1922, because Peter is the head of the Rittle station. In an ex-army hut, which is in a corner of a flooded field down at the bottom of Lawford Lane, isolated so they can do their radio experiments, and they can also land aircraft across in the field, which was actually during World War One, Royal Naval Air Service fighter station for a year that fought Zeppelins. And Burroughs says to Eckersley, we'd like you to do this thing called broadcasting. And Eckersley says, that's Chelmsford's job. No, it's your job. And they then tell him that they've got less than 2 weeks to prepare because the license starts on February the 14th, 1922. Eckersley thinks he's mad, but they have a transmitter, a spare one for the Croydon air traffic control system sitting in the corner. And Eckersley sort of scratches his head and thinks, well, this could be fun. And that's when the world changes again. And that's how we're now at Rittle. The call sign that the experimental station used was 2MT, just part of the 2 series. Probably stands for 2 Marconi test. It was allocated really on a first come first basis. And Eckersley thinks, well, yes, we can do this. Their license says they can only transmit for half an hour a week in the evening. Burroughs tells them there's no extra money. All the expenses have to be met by their own pocket, and any equipment they use has to be put back into normal use during the day. Eckersley says, that's a good deal. But still, they persevere. And then what happens on St. Valentine's Day, February 1922, is why you and I are sitting here today.
Yeah.
What happens next changes the world forever.
So did the BBC come about as a result of 2MT?
Yes, basically, we are now looking at the summer of 1922. The first broadcast goes out on Valentine's Day at 7 o'clock in the evening. But by the time they'd sorted out all the calibration signals they had to send, the mandatory 3-minute shutdowns to make sure they weren't interfering with legitimate sources. And they had a big breakdown. On the first night, the equipment actually blew up and had to be, they had probably a 15-minute break. So we actually think the broadcast goes out about 7:30 on February the 14th.
Right.
And be perfectly honest, it was a little staid. Ashbridge, Eckersley's number two, was at the microphone. Peter Eckersley actually went home on his motorbike. He lived in Witham.
Yeah.
To listen in. And he wasn't impressed the next morning, if truth be known, because Ashbridge wasn't a natural raconteur. But what you had was simply, hello, this is 2MT Riddle. They played some gramophone records and they shut down. It was useful for calibration, but Eckersley just thought we could do so much more. So a week later, Peter Eckersley steps the microphone, and this is cometh the hour, cometh the man, the right man in the right place at the right time. Because Peter Eckersley, on one hand, is a brilliant engineer. He's worked through the First World War. He's probably he's one of the leading engineers in the world for speech telephony and broadcasting radio out. But he's also a unique personality. He is a natural raconteur. He's a wit. He hates authority. It caused him huge issues in the military. He's a natural pricker of balloons, hates pomposity. He is also a natural humorist, raconteur. And what Peter Eckersley will do during the summer of 1922 will change the world, because it will define the art and science of radio for 100 years to come. Because when Eckersley steps to the microphone, as we're sat here, he sees beyond all the wires and the valves, and he talks to the listener as if they're in the room with them.
Yeah.
You have to remember that this has never been done before. Everybody clamps their earphones on tight. They tickle the cat's whisker radio, which was radio for free. You didn't even need a battery. And suddenly into their ears comes the voice of Peter Eckersley. He's your best friend. He's giving you news. He's given you music. They're now doing live music. And over the next 6 months, he's going to do the first ever radio play, the first ever children's pieces. He thought children were the future of radio. They had to listen in. He did the first fan club, the first radio quiz, the first Radio Lonely Hearts Club. It all comes out of his amazing imagination. The radio transmissions were meant to be half an hour. After an hour, he just got into his stride. There was no rules with Eckersley. There was no filters. Jokes, some of them quite blue, even by today's standards. Stories, humour. The very first sound effects studio will come out of this Riddle hut. Everyone thinks Monty Python did Horses, Hooves of Coconuts. No, it's Riddle. The first sandboxes, the first slamming doors, sometimes a lot of it by accident. Eckersley loved banging beer bottles and playing records at the wrong speed. He'd drill holes off centre on the record. He'd smear marmalade and jam on it because their listeners liked to hear what it sounded like.
Sounds a bit like one of my programmes.
So I understand. He did a night of grand opera. Now, Eckersley was not an opera singer. He could not play the piano. But he pretended that there was a concert coming from Rome. Signor Gridlico, which is a nice pun for radio engineers out there. And I think you can now listen to Peter Eckersley on that famous summer night as he entertains listeners. And before you play this clip, just imagine you've never heard radio before. All you've heard is the static of Morse code for 10 years if you've had the ability. And suddenly, Peter Pendleton Eckersley comes into your life and your world's going to change forever. So that was Peter Eckersley.
Right.
It's an incredible side. And even today, that was played for a lot of the school children in Rittle only a couple of weeks ago, and they absolutely loved it and cracked up 100 years later. He has an infectious humour. Oh, yes, he had diplomatic instances. He blamed the Icelandic government for all the bad weather. He had a personal mission to insult the train operators who demanded his sacking, actually, because there was always problems with the train lines. In fact, Eckersley is a member of the Goons, yet only one of the Goons has been born, and he's in nappies. So DJ, raconteur, humorist. By the end of the summer of 1922, it is clear that something amazing has happened in this small field in Essex. For instance, the Port of Liverpool will not move ships between 7 and 8 when Eckersley's online. They want to listen in. Hansard records that Parliament retires for half an hour to listen to 2MT at Rittle. In fact, under the phonetic alphabet, it becomes known as 2MATOC, Rittle testing. So what you've now got is suddenly the government is bombarded. The post office, who are in charge of communications back then, are bombarded by requests for more stations.
Right.
Please give us more stations. We want to do our thing. We'd also like to advertise our product, taking the American model. And suddenly Metropolitan Vickers, a rival to Marconi, is in Manchester, get the call sign 2ZY, which is their normal call sign, and say, well, we're going to start a station. And they're in preparation. And the post office says, no. We've got to bring some organization to this potential chaos. Don't forget that Eckersley just carries on. He doesn't care about all this. He's just doing his thing behind the microphone. He is the power behind his microphone. If listeners ever get the chance, his biography was written in 1941. It is a fantastic book. It's still available in places. If you can't find it, I wrote a book in 2010 called 2MT Rittle, The Birth of Broadcasting, which basically stole a lot of what Eckersley wrote. I think the guy is an amazing character. However, where we are now is that the post office calls a great meeting, which is basically dominated by the Marconi company because they hold all the patents for radio. So nothing's going to happen without Marconi. And the managing director, Godfrey Isaacs, really sort of stamps his authority on the proceedings and is the founder. And what they come up with after a series of meetings is that they need a single organization, a single company, an entity that is separate from the radio companies and separate from government that will actually run British broadcasting. And after a huge amount of effort, they call it and decide that it's going to have a name and they ought to call it the British Broadcasting Company, which, because that's a mouthful, they're going to call it the BBC. So really, this organization is formed by the big six manufacturers putting money in. It's going to be funded by the fact that the radio sets will have a tax put on the sale of each radio set commercially made. Although that's not going to work very well because most of these radio amateurs build their own equipment.
Yeah.
Though they come up with a license fee, 10 shillings a year, which is actually still
a lot of money in those days.
It's a lot of money, but guess what? You can't enforce it, so everybody's going to listen in for free. So the new BBC is going to struggle. But it's also going to need a radio station. Now, 2MT is actually a long way into the wilds of rural Essex.
Yeah.
But it has a second station, starts in May 1922, run by Marconi's from Marconi House in the Strand in the middle of London. Arthur Burroughs, who'd been trying to control Eckersley, given up. He'd gone to start a station in London and its call sign was 2LO.
Right.
2LO for London. Very small station, only running 100 watts, operating from the theatre above Marconi House. And they actually had to sometimes crawl underneath because it was actually the theatre was used for training films for Marconi employees. But the advantage of 2LO was it's in the middle of London. Back then, a potential of around 2 million listeners, all looking listening with great clarity on a crystal set. Now, 2LO couldn't broadcast music. It had no license. It was very staid and formed because Arthur Burroughs believed that broadcasting should be proper. all this wit and humour that you should enunciate, you should inform, educate, and allow listeners to take the very best from it. Peter Eckersley liked to smash ginger beer bottles live on air and entertain, because at the hut you used to get a big audience all sitting outside the hut late in the evening, and they let just the children in the front of the microphone, so the hut was packed. So Eckersley had his own audience, which he loved. But Burroughs, no, this was going to be proper. But the BBC decided that the 2LO was a great station to take over. After Burroughs jumped ship from Marconi Company to the new BBC, becoming one of the very first employees, and in November 1922, hello, this is 2LO calling.
2LO Marconi House, London calling. 2LO Marconi House, London calling. 2LO Marconi House, London calling.
The voice of the BBC is Arthur Burroughs. As he said, he's going to read it once quickly and once slowly, and you have to write in and tell him how you enjoyed it. Eckersley didn't care. He knew you were listening. But this is the BBC. The BBC is born in 1922. It has come directly from everything that Eckersley and the 2MT Riddle team will do. And indeed, as the BBC grows, they suddenly realise they need an operation. They're going to be based in Marconi House under the umbrella of Marconi's for the next year. They employ a new general manager. His name is John Reith. He will join on the 1st of January, 1923. And the first thing he realizes is that he's a financier. He knows nothing about radio. He has a look around. Who is the expert in radio? Well, it's a guy called Peter Eckersley. He picks the phone up through Major Basil Binion, himself a wartime radio pioneer who's become a director of the BBC, and says, we need Eckersley. There are many variations in the story, but essentially at the end of January 1923, Peter Eckersley goes up to London, sits down with Reith. And although these two men are chalk and cheese, Eckersley, the wild extrovert, genius radio entrepreneur, Reith, the staid Presbyterian, formal manager, 6'4" with a huge scar from the war on his cheek, somehow they gel. Eckersley goes back to Marconi's, tells his wife that he's just quit his job with the company he loves, and he's going to join this new BBC. He arrives in February 1923. He knows he is the chief engineer because he's the only engineer. When he leaves 7 years later, he's built the engineering department to over 700 engineers. 90% of the British population can hear radio on two separate channels. You have the shortwave scheme, you have international radio, you have a regional scheme, relay stations. Eckersley and Reith will build the BBC into what it becomes now. They also open the door in 1927 to John Logie Baird. Mm. They do the first television experiments. Now, his system will fail, but the EMI Marconi electronic system, developed by Isaac Schoenberg and his team in Hayes with EMI, when it's demonstrated in 1932, everyone goes, and all your listeners would recognize that as television.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the importance of that is that although television is just an experiment in the early 1930s, it has a much more important task, in as much what they're developing now is what you know as a television screen.
Sure.
If you call it a cathode ray tube.
Yep.
High power transmissions. Basically, they're developing something we will now call radar, such that by 1938, we can roll out 28 chain home radar stations and we will win the Battle of Britain. Now, the link to everything that Eckersley did in the field is clear. You know, the engineers, the pioneers of 2MTOC Riddle sow the seeds and start the technological explosion that we now know as the modern world. Mm-hmm. Everything is going to come out of what they start, including the mass manufacture of electronic equipment. So the domestic radio sets, because not everybody's a radio amateur, not everybody likes to tickle cat's whiskers or solder or put valves in, because they can be quite difficult to someone they don't want to play. Yeah. So the explosion in building radio equipment Bakelite, lovely sets, architectural masterpieces through the 1920s. But that is the growth of high capacity electronic manufacture, which then, as you come to World War II, is going to save the nation. And that leads on to the growth of the computers, transistors, and everything we now know, the fact that transistor radios that we buy in huge quantities. Sadly, a lot of that industry has gone over to other countries, but it all starts in Britain as we go through what I've always called our third industrial revolution.
The 2MT only lasted for about a year, didn't it?
It did. So where it starts in Valentine's Day, 14th of February, 1922. Mm. Eckersley goes up in January, still doing the shows. He comes back and it closes down at the end of January, 1923. It operates for 11 months. During those last 3 months, it is the only station to have legally shared the airwaves with the BBC until the advent of independent radio in the 1960s and how we're talking today.
Yeah.
Eckersley said goodbye to his listeners with a tear in his eye. Ginger beer, he loved ginger beer, popped the cork, told everybody it was the best champagne they could afford, and toasted his listeners and thanked them very much for listening in, and closed down 2MT on January the 17th, 1923. In its short career and lifespan, which is what we're celebrating with a centenary this year, it really, I mean, I've been writing this story for over 30 years. 38 years ago, I first wrote an article for Practical Wireless, one of the magazines that came out of this explosion. I wrote a book in 1998 and another one in 2010. Yeah. And we've sort of kept on looking at this story. And as you look at what Peter Eckersley will go on to do, and that's a story for another day, but I find it absolutely amazing that, you know, these young men from a partially flooded field will start this explosion that's going to change the world forever just because one man had the sheer wit, audacity, and joie de vivre to step to a microphone and go, "Hello, CQ, this is 2MT Top Riddle Testing, and tonight you're going to hear the most wonderful singer." Oh, sometimes singers fail, you know. and I think really everybody should listen to Peter Eckersley again and understand just how good he was. And however, and one thing too, really, which is sad, is that when he went to the BBC, one of the problems was John Reith was not prepared to put him in front of a microphone because the new BBC was going to be super serious. The announcers would now wear evening attire, off with a red carnation, evening jackets. It was going to be proper pronunciation. They actually developed something called BBC Perceived Pronunciation. They even write out to the mayor of every town in England, "How would you like your town pronounced?" There was going to be, on Sundays, it was going to be religious broadcasting. Yes, they do plays, but it would be serious plays and serious drama and serious music and serious entertainment. Reith and Burroughs were going to educate and inform. And whether they entertained, well, that was a story for another day. But don't forget, suddenly people are going to hear a night of proper opera, a concert from the greatest halls in the world, which they'd never be able to afford. It didn't matter if you were in a little croft on the west coast of Scotland or the southwest of Cornwall or on a fishing boat off Felixstowe, you could hear this amazing mixture of music and news and entertainment coming into your headphones and soon loudspeakers. So I think really the BBC probably would not have survived if Eckersley had been allowed in front of the microphone during 1923. I don't know whether lawsuits or whether he'd been arrested, because when he was in form, it was just something to behold.
I think it's amazing that he and, as you said earlier, that John Reith actually could work together. I'm amazed from what you've said about him. But anyway, look, back to 2MT, because you're going to be involved in a number of celebratory events in Rittle and around the area, are you not?
That's right. I mean, pandemics aside, it's been very difficult to plan. But I think, yes, on February the 14th, there's going to be a few things in the evening, not least of which a new radio play, which recreates, hopefully, some of the thought of a Peter Eckersley concert. And yep, you'll be debuting there.
Indeed, we'll be playing that. This very evening at 7:30. We'll be playing.
That's a world exclusive. And we put that together in the height of the pandemic. And you'll even hear Mr. Eckersley. And if you go online, there's also a just search for 2MT Rittle. You'll find a streamed version of that as well, with historic inserts. So you can see the real people who are actually on the radio play. So we're very pleased with that. We're also doing a series of live broadcasts. I'm doing one with community radio from inside the original Rittle Hut, which is now safe and preserved at Sanford Mill with Chelmsford Museum Services. One of your sister stations is doing, well, BBC Essex, who owe their existence to Mr. Eckersley. They're setting up a very cold outside broadcast from exactly the car park at where the Rittle Hut used to stand, which is now sadly called Melba Court. Dame Nellie Melba never sang for 2MT at Rittle. Yeah. They couldn't have afforded the superstar, although Lawrence Melchior did go. So they're doing that. We're trying to just really tell the story exactly 100 yards to the minute. And when I'm in the hut, hopefully, as we start to play Peter Eckersley, maybe the ghosts will huddle in. I hope they smile, because we will.
I'm sure they will.
As we move forward in May, I'm doing a large lecture on May the 17th at Rittle University, which is called 2MT Rittle and the Birth of British Broadcasting. That all the proceeds are going towards Rittle Heritage. And I'll be telling this story, but illustrated with slides and lots of audio. And I tend to storm around the stage. I have to sit in front of the microphone, so it's a little difficult for me. But we'll be doing that. Might even be doing two evenings now, because it's proving to be quite popular. And then at the weekend of the 21st of May, there are a whole series of events in Rittle. A lot of schools involved, Chelmsford Amateur Radio there. They're also doing from the Village Hall on special event call sign with 2MT broadcasting again on the 14th. But they'll be back in May. We're doing as a special church service on the Sunday morning. There's in the Village Hall and in tents, there's exhibitions, there's mini lectures. And if you look at Chelmsford City Walks with Alan and myself bringing up the rear, because I'm not as fast as I used to be, we're doing a series of 90-minute walks, which you have to book online. But we're walking around Rittle and telling people when and where and how it happened. And really, hopefully allowing people to step back 100 years. And I hope with everything at the lectures, just get a sense of the amazing experience and the sheer I'm almost lost for words to say how incredibly it was to clamp your Bakelite headphones on tight and this happened. Well, you'd never heard it before. Today we have thousands of radio stations, internet, and we just take it as second nature, but back then it was nothing short of magic.
Indeed. Absolute. Well, look, Tim, thanks very much indeed for taking the time out to talk with us today. Good luck with all of those centenary celebrations. I'm sure you won't need it, because I think they'll be an absolute blast.
Well, that's really kind of you to say so. I say this has been a story I've lived with for nearly 40 years since I went to the Rittle site as a young software engineer back in 1982. And I've just joined the Marconi Veterans. A big shout out for that organization. Of course, sadly, we lost the Marconi company in 2005. That again is another story. But, you know, for 100 years, even a lot more, that company and indeed the engineers, generation of engineers, have built the modern world.
Yeah.
And I guess everything we're doing is a celebration of that that success and indeed many failures. But I think now as you tune into your radio station and the BBC, maybe on February the 14th, just pour a glass of ginger beer or your best champagne and toast Peter Eckersley and team and just say, hello, CQ. This is 2M O'Clock Riddle. We're closing down for the evening.